We should be opened up to political process and letting all of our citizens come in and participate. People died for the right to vote. Friends of mine, colleagues of mine.
Last Friday, the country lost two giants of the civil rights movement, Representative John Lewis, who you heard there, and Reverend C.T. Vivian, two particularly devastating losses for the country and particularly for Black Americans, many who have been fighting for racial justice and whose communities have also been disproportionately affected by COVID-19. It almost seems unfair to lose these two giants now. We'll talk about Representative Lewis in a few minutes, but we want to start with remembering Reverend C.T. Vivian, who was slightly less in the public eye. He was a Baptist minister and one of Dr. Martin Luther King's closest advisors.
What we were doing was creating a new South, huh? As a part of a whole new concept of our participation in the nation, right? And so that when you see people who are thinking like that for a lifetime, how important it is that you know that it opens doors and that people take you seriously, more seriously than they did before.
Vivian helped lead boycotts, marches, and sit-ins at lunch counters during the civil rights movement. And after that, he helped found numerous civil rights organizations. Vivian died in his home in Atlanta at the age of 95. Joining me now is Greg Carr, associate professor at Howard University and the chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies. Greg, thanks for joining us.
It's a real pleasure, Tenzina. I really admire your work, and it's great to be in this conversation this morning, today.
Well, let me tell you that for a hot Monday, that put a great smile on my face. We appreciate you joining us.
Yes.
You know, when we talk about a lot of the civil rights figures, there's so many that come to mind. We don't often hear about Vivian. Tell us how he got his start in the civil rights movement.
And that's truly unfortunate. And that's why I'm particularly glad that you took some time with the takeaway today to talk about both of them in tandem. Cordy Tyndall Vivian was born in Missouri, just outside of Boonville, Missouri, in 1924. And at 6 years old, he moved to Macomb, Illinois. He was raised and trained in integrated schools and went to Western Illinois University. And he is a figure who is an intellectual, really, who became an activist. As you say, he was a minister. And in 1957, he went to the American Baptist Theological Seminary in my hometown of Nashville. And that's where he actually talked to Martin Luther King. He had met Dr. King. He had studied Dr. King a little bit. And then he met Jim Lawson, James Lawson, who is still alive. It's very important because Lawson is really the figure, a minister himself, who brought C.T. Vivian into what became the nonviolent strategies that fed the Nashville movement. I know we're going to talk about John Lewis in a minute, but Lewis was a student by then at the same seminary that that Vivian was at, and they engaged together with others in what we know as the Nashville Student Movement, about a three-month period that really gave birth, along with the work that was being done in North Carolina A&T and Bennett College in North Carolina, to what we call the student phase of the modern civil rights movement. Within a year, C.T. Vivian was at the Freedom Rides. He became a pastor in Chattanooga the year after that, 1962. And by the following year, he was on Martin Luther King's staff. So C.T. Vivian is an anchor person for us to understand that moment in American and world history.
What were C.T. Vivian's main priorities once he entered the movement?
Well, Vivian, interestingly enough, was brought on to Dr. King's staff kind of as a lieutenant for Wyatt T. Walker, who was another one of these great intellectuals out of Virginia, a New York pastor for many years. Vivian was brought in as eventually the director of affiliates. So he was kind of a tip of the spear guy. He was on the steps in St. Augustine, Florida. In fact, he was almost killed there. He was in Selma in 1965. His job was to coordinate the affiliates of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to kind of engage in this direct action protest. What Wyatt T. Walker by 1963 in Birmingham called Operation C, confrontation. And they narrated their villains very carefully, the Bull Connors of Birmingham's, the Jim Clarks of Selma. And that's where we see C.T. Vivian confronting Jim Clark on the courthouse steps in Selma. And of course, he very famously gets struck by that sheriff, and that kind of galvanizes and electrifies the movement in tandem with John Lewis, who, of course, was on the bridge at Edmund Pettus Bridge down the street. in Selma. So his philosophy of nonviolence, his intellect, his moral and courage and conviction kind of congeal in this confrontational style, even in his eloquence in having that confrontation that makes C.T. Vivian part of the tip of the spear of that movement in the 1962 to 65.
Vivian and John Lewis, who we're going to talk about in the next segment, knew each other. And I'm wondering, Greg, can you tell us what their relationship was like?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's very interesting. We tend to freeze John Lewis on that bridge and freeze C.T. Vivian on those steps. But, you know, they both, 1965, that important year where we see the passage of the Voting Rights Act, after 1965, they become kind of these iconic figures in the ongoing struggle for human and civil rights in this country. 1965 was also the year I was born. So in many ways, they became kind of North Stars for those of us who were born in that generation and after to look to in terms of how to conduct ourselves, in terms of protest and struggle, and how to think about the meaning of being African in America and the evolving American democracy. Vivian, of course, went on. He moved to Chicago in 1966. He started the Urban Training Center there to work on getting young people, advancing the lives of young people. He was an architect of Upward Bound, which we know is a very important program. But in short, he lived the rest of his life, eventually relocating to Atlanta, helping Jesse Jackson run for president in 1984. He lived his rest of his life kind of as a spokesperson for that thrust of continual protest to reconstruct, in some ways, the nature of American democracy. That's why he's so iconic, and that's why it's so important to talk about him and lift his voice in this moment as well.
You met him in person. Was there one thing that stood out to you, Greg?
C.T. Vivian was a world-class bibliophile. First time I met him in Knoxville, Tennessee, we talked about books. And the gleam in his eye, he kind of reminded me of my father. He kind of looked like my father. And we talked about books. And it's very important to understand that he was one of the great minds of his generation. And he believed in preserving memory and education. And in some ways, that's probably his greatest legacy, education. We must always study to improve ourselves so that we can improve the society we live in.
We're talking about civil rights leaders Reverend C.T. Vivian and Representative John Lewis, who both passed away on Friday.
Before the Voting Rights Act of 1965, it was almost impossible for many people in the state of Georgia, in Alabama, in Virginia, in Texas, to register to vote, to participate in the democratic process. It's shameful.
This bill is a slap in the face of the Declaration of Independence. It denies gay men and women the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Marriage is a basic human right.
Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now.
John Lewis was the son of a sharecropper in Alabama who became a hugely important leader in the civil rights movement as a young man, and he later went on to become a congressman representing Georgia's 5th District in the House for more than 30 years. Lewis died in his home city of Alabama from pancreatic cancer at the age of 80. Greg, probably one of the most, I mean, just listening to John Lewis's voice there, you know, you can't help but feel that voice. And I think one of the most interesting, among many of the interesting things about John Lewis was how his fight for equality spanned so many issues. We heard him at the top talking about LGBTQ marriage rights. Is that something that was unique to John Lewis in the way that he framed equality?
Yes, I actually think it was not only unique to Congressman Lewis in the public imagination in this country, but it was also representative, in fact, of a broad swath of African people in this country when it comes to the principled defense of our common humanity. John Lewis, all of his colleagues, Stokely Carmichael, so many others who might disagree with him sometimes ideologically, would say something that I hear often from the SNCC veterans who are still with us. John had the courage of his convictions, they would say. Congressman Lewis was consistent, if nothing else, in his faith and belief in his religion and in the possibilities of the American experiment. So it would, of course, come as no surprise to any of them that he would defend everyone's right not to be in harm's way.
And also, John Lewis decided to run for Congress. I mean, ultimately trying to, as some folks would describe it, making change from within the same federal government that had been oppressing Black Americans. Why did he decide to make that move?
Well, that's a fascinating question, Tanzina. I think that is a lesser known side of John Lewis, I think. And some of his colleagues would say, you know, John was a gentleman. He had the courage of his convictions. And John was also possible. He had the possibility of being bare knuckled in his political brawls. The congressional election of 1986 between John Lewis and his friend, his brother, really, Julian Bond, is one of the most controversial elections in the history of Black American electoral politics. John Lewis had actually approached Julian Bond when that district kind of opened up in the wake of the Voting Rights Act to run for that position himself. And in between that candidacy, because Julian Bond decided he wouldn't run, Andrew Young ran, became the first African American since Reconstruction to be elected out of Georgia. And then when John Lewis ran, Julian Bond actually declared before. So what you saw was really, in some ways, the class divides in Black communities. Julian Bond won the majority of Black votes in that election. John Lewis won the majority of white votes in that district and was sent to Congress. And there were charges that Lewis kind of played up his all shucks, plain spoken kind of persona. He called himself a workhorse in contrast to Julian Bond, who he called a show horse. And so even with all his years in Congress and his courage of conviction stances, what we see at that moment is John Lewis becomes in many ways more of the public face of the civil rights movement and the so-called conscience of the Congress than a Julian Bond type or a C.T. Vivian type, which may have been perhaps even, frankly, more unsettling to the American body politic in terms of representing what that movement meant and means.
And Greg, I'm wondering, I've been thinking a lot about him being called the conscience of Congress, and I'm wondering whether or not that was a burden to Representative Lewis.
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, why would any Black person or Black people or any non-white person in this country have to be called upon to be the conscience of a country when we all have a conscience? So when John Lewis, who said he regretted not standing with Barbara Lee, for example, in condemning the Iraq war and voting against authorization for Bush to go into the war. For John Lewis, who sat on the floor of the United States Congress, joined by Nancy Pelosi and some of the youngsters who had come in, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley and others, to say we must pass gun violence legislation. Why would it be on John Lewis or anyone else, for example, to have to set out that marker when there are 400 plus members of the federal legislature? It's an incredible burden, and it's a testament to John Lewis's strength that he was able to not only hold up under that burden, but to continue to carry that responsibility, which I suppose, you know, accrues to the benefit of us all.
There, do we know anything about his reaction to two things, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act and the killing of George Floyd? To imagine that John Lewis had spent his entire life fighting for these issues to leave us at a moment where we are at such, where there's such an uprising and such a battle for some of the basic protections that Black and white Americans, or largely Black Americans, I should say, have still not been offered. Do we know what his reaction was to these two issues right now?
Oh, absolutely, Tanzina. He spoke until the end. In terms of voting rights, of course, he suffered there in that bridge in 1965. His very good friend Jim Clyburn has said that there must be a restoration of the Voting Rights Act, and he has suggested it be renamed the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. So we know that he spoke out in favor of restoring the Civil Rights Act. He shed blood. And as far as the young people are concerned, you know, John Lewis was 21 years old when they pulled him off that bus in Anniston, Alabama, and tried to kill him with the Freedom Rides. He stood in the Black Lives Matter painting there on 16th Street alongside the mayor of D.C. and said, "I stand with Black Lives Matter." And more importantly, he stood with the organizers of Black Lives Matter. So John Lewis, right until the day that he made transition, was a very vocal supporter of the youth energy, the intergenerational, multiracial contingent that is engaged in this general strike against the American social order. John Lewis let us know what he thought until the very end, and he stood on the side of right in those cases.
Greg Carr, wonderful talking to you. Greg Carr is an associate professor at Howard University and the chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Greg.
It's a pleasure, Tanzina, and please continue the good work. I'll be listening to The Takeaway.
I just feel like I've been placed on this little piece of real estate that we call Earth to do something as I pass through on this journey.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.